finally going to talk about the bounce phase, probably the most interesting part. And I might have alluded to it yesterday already, but what we need in order to resolve the singularity, the Big Bang singularity, can basically be classified into three different things. The one thing we could do is to our GR model, we could add some exotic matter. Which will, for example, allow for a violation of the null energy condition. What we could also do is we could modify gravity itself. And then the third option is, of course, to go and see what a quantum theory of gravity would tell us about the singularity. Okay, so what I want to do next is go through a list of different models, each one in one of these different categories. And then, because we don't have the time, of course, to go into detail for all of them, I just want to show you two different ones in a bit more detail. One of them will be the ghost condensate, which will add exotic matter, and we will see how it will be able to violate the null energy condition. And the other one is called the perfect bounce. which is basically a minimal extension that gives us a quantum bounce. Okay, but first, let me give you a bit of an overview. We can start by looking at quantum gravity-based models. And the obvious reason why quantum gravity is a good way to go is that, of course, the singularity comes about in exactly the regime where general relativity is supposed to break down, right? It's not supposed to be valid anymore. That's what the singularity tells us. So of course, quantum gravity should be able to resolve that. We have two contenders. We have loop quantum cosmology, which is based on loop quantum gravity. Which was developed by Ashtekar, Singh, and others. And what loop quantum gravity does is it basically quantizes space and time like you would quantize, for example, energy and momentum in just standard quantum mechanics. And what that means is that you'll end up with space and time that are granular and discrete. Like, for example, you would have discrete energy levels in an atom. And also it means that there's then a minimum distance. And loop quantum cosmology takes that theory and simplifies it dramatically by assuming homogeneity and I think isotropy. Definitely homogeneity. So it basically simplifies the model to something you would get in an FRW metric. And there's still some debate about whether, you know, you can simply do that, or whether if you were to use the full theory, see what the singularity would give you, and then simplify to a homogeneous model, if these would converge to the same theory. What it gives you is basically a new repulsive force. And this repulsive force is negligible at small space-time curvatures. But at large space-time curvatures, like at the Big Bang, it overcomes the classical attraction close to the Planck scale, which then leads to a minimal scale factor. So you end up with a non-singular bounce. Okay. The second theory I want to talk about is called canonical quantum gravity. Which was developed by, well, it's all based on formalism by Dirac and de Witt and Bergman. It basically uses the Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity, and it's based on the canonical quantization techniques for constrained Hamiltonian systems that was developed by Dirac. Right, and to make this very brief, what this leads to is it provides a wave function of the universe and what Pinto, Neto, and others have shown is that this wave function vanishes as soon as the scale factor vanishes, and thereby it spontaneously basically avoids the singularity. And in most cases, you then get a bounce in these models. Okay, both of these models, of course, because they're based on quantum gravity, and as you know, we don't really have a full theory of quantum gravity yet, they both need a lot more work so that you can actually, you know, be sure about what they predict in terms of observables, so that you can actually compare the predictions to what we observe in our universe. Also, I'm not an expert, but there are a lot of people working on quantum gravity here at PI. So you should ask them. Okay, next model is called string gas cosmology. And was developed by Robert Brandenburger and others. And it's based on the fact that there's a maximal temperature in string theory called the Hargadon temperature. As soon as you approach this temperature, there are new massless degrees of freedom that arise, and that can indicates a phase transition, and you can model this by a string gas, and the string gas then provides you with the possibility of violating the null energy condition in a controlled way. So what you can end up with is a non-singular bounce. Thank you. Okay, what has to be said here in this model is that there's actually no mathematical description yet. Because you would need non-perturbative string theory, which doesn't exist yet. So it's all, it's a model, right? So you can effectively describe it, but it's not, of course, it's not full string theory. So there's a lot of more work that needs to be done here as well. Also, as far as I understood, the theory doesn't actually explain the flatness of our universe. That's just one caveat. Right. Okay. Again, I'm not an expert. So I'll just move on to the next one. The original ekpyrotic cyclic universe was developed by several people, among them Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok. And it's a singular bounds, which is based on heterotic M theory. And the idea was to have two 3+1-dimensional brains connected by an extra dimension, and one of these brains would basically be just our universe. So we'd have a picture. Well, you'd have this extra dimension. So this is just the 3+1 brain. And you would have a second brain, and it would be, they would just be connected by this line segment, also called orbifold. And the idea was that there would be a force between these brains which would make them attract to each other. And then whenever they would collide with each other, that would be identified with the Big Bang or Big Bounce. And then they would just continue. They would just continue moving. I mean, the collision is not, you know, it's not really like some sort of elastic collision. It would basically, you could either think of it as an elastic collision where the brains then just move away from each other again, or they go through each other. I mean, it's not really, either way to think about it is fine. And then they would start moving away from each other, and this attractive force would then eventually make them stop, and they would be attracted towards each other again. And in this way, you would end up with a cyclic universe. And I think I mentioned this briefly yesterday, is that in this theory, you automatically get two scalars in your effective four-dimensional theory. Because one of them, you get from the size of this line segment. And the other one, we're using string theory. So at every point here on the brain, you have to imagine that there's all the extra dimensions compactified on your Calabi-Yau manifold. And what that does is, in four dimension, it effectively gives you another scalar, which describes the volume of the Calabi-Yau compactification. Okay, so as I said, originally it's based on heterotic M theory, but you can just view the whole theory as just an effective four-dimensional theory. You don't really have to have this picture in mind, right? It could be one of the explanations where everything comes from, but it doesn't have to be. Like in inflation, and we just make up all the models with like our scalar field and a potential, but you know, we think it should come from like a more fundamental model, but more fundamental theory, but we don't know what that is. But effectively, you know, if it turned out to be describable like that in four dimensions, then that's what we would get. So we can do the same thing here and just take everything in four dimensions as bare value and, you know, have that as our model. Yeah.
I don't understand in this picture, like, what does like this distance between the two brains have to do with the size of the universe in the 3+1 patches? I mean, it's like I don't understand why this, but this moves implies something happening in here. Like, what's the like the connection you have between the closeness of these guys with what's happening in each one of them?
Okay, so I don't exactly know how it works in detail, but just more or less, in general, what you would do is you would, you know. This would be a, I don't know, 11-dimensional theory? 10-dimensional? Does anyone know hadronic M theory? Anyway, so you would have the full dimensional theory, and you would want to see what effectively, in four dimensions, what kind of dynamics would emerge from that. So, right, so you would have to do some dimensional reduction, and then somehow, effectively, you know, these properties like the volume of the compactification or the size of this line element, they would enter into your theory.
Okay.
And all I can say is basically that they would enter as a scalar field.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Right. So you could describe this as GR plus two scalar fields. Yeah, it's a lot more complicated.
No.
In you know, if you actually go into the details. Yeah, well, string theory.
The line segment is actually in the compact. Is there a theory, the line segment in the clavio?
The line segment is extra, I think.
I don't know this theory, but
yeah. So you know, every point here would have like the compactification, and then in addition, you would have. You know, you would have the separation between the two brains.
It's just when you use brains to do inflation, normally that the separation.
Yeah,
is,
it's part of.
It's part of the clock. Yeah.
Right.
So, I don't understand.
I would have to look that up. I'm not sure. Yeah, could be. Okay, so if we just look at this effectively, we can just see what our scalar field would do in a potential, as we like to do. So today, we're somewhere here. There's a small positive cosmological constant, which you can model with just basically a stationary, so a pure cosmological constant would just be a scalar field sitting in a minimum, not moving at all, right? So we still don't know if our cosmological constant, or I should rather say if dark energy is actually a cosmological constant, so if it's constant, or if it's just very, very slowly varying, and we just haven't measured that yet. So in theory, we could be here. And we could be very, very slowly moving in that direction. And then what could happen is that the potential actually crosses zero and goes into an ekbarotic phase, like we discussed yesterday. Okay, so we're just basically at the start of the dark energy phase. So that dark energy phase could go on for a very, very long time because we're very, very slowly moving here. But then eventually, we will cross V equal to zero, and that will then mean that we start contracting. And because the potential is so steep, we would roll very fast, and we would be in an ekbrotic phase, which, of course, at some point will have to come to an end. Otherwise, we'll just keep contracting. OK, so we go back up. Oh yeah, I should say. So the dark energy phase, of course, means that W is much larger than 1. No, it's approximately minus 1, sorry. Here, in the ekbrotic phase, W was much larger than 1. And then when we basically turn off the potential again, we're in a regime where the potential becomes unimportant. And because we've been rolling so fast, this phase is actually dominated by the kinetic energy of the scalar fields, called kinetic phase. And then we can add a bounce, right, somewhere here. And, you know, I'll talk about some of the options we have for bounds, for example, in this model. One is the ghost condensate that I'll talk about in a bit. So we would go through. There would be another kinetic phase just right after the bounds. And then we would enter, you know, the universe that we know. There would be radiation domination, matter domination. And then what could happen is that this just goes back to the dark energy phase. And then all of this could just repeat, right? That's where the cyclicity comes in. You get a cyclic model if you just, you know, continue doing that. Something like that. Okay? So just effectively, in 4 dimensions, if you had such a potential, that would be the universe that would emerge. Question, of course, is where does it come from? But yeah.
So during the radiation and matter dominating phase, the potential is actually much, much higher than?
I don't know if I've drawn this to scale, to be honest. It might also be somewhere down here.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Now we are like 10 to the minus 120.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. Well, it's you know, it's larger than the dark energy phase. That's what I can tell you. So maybe more something like that. It's not drawn to scale.
Yeah, but like just naively, you think if you have a ball rolling slowly here,
yeah.
And how do they climb back to some?
Oh yeah, sure, of course. So this must definitely be less than that, otherwise it wouldn't go over. Is that what you're saying?
What?
Well, we're coming in from here, right?
We are here,
yeah.
And we're not moving very fast.
Exactly. So you don't have much kinetic energy, just
exactly.
A bit of potential energy.
Exactly. So
and
you
then
end up somewhere. Almost exactly the same.
Oh, okay. Right. So the thing is, I haven't mentioned that yet, is that in this universe, not the whole space-time will actually make it through the bounds. Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, I mean, already the old Greeks had the idea of a cyclic universe. But then that was, you know, as soon as physicists started to think about it, they realized you can't do that. Because you immediately run into an entropy problem. You can't just, you know, have like an expanding universe with like entropy increasing, and then it would just, you know, it can't just go through a cycle mm-hmm. and stay the same size. That's just, you know, immediately ruled out. So the way this works is that actually only some part of say our future universe actually has then the right initial conditions to make it through the bounds. And the vast majority of the region will just crunch. Okay? Right, so that's how you. Okay, yeah, so I should add a few remarks. Okay, so the first one would be only a small fraction actually make it through. But I mean, that's fine. You just, you know, have some large region of space-time that crunches. But then as long as the dark energy phase lasts for at least 60 e-folds, you produce more space than, you know, than would actually, you know, you would lose through crunching. So what you can actually have, if you have more than 60 e-folds of dark energy, what you could have is some sort of like first cycle, which could be very, very small. But then it would set up the conditions for the next cycle such that it would grow more and more and more, so that we kind of dynamically arrive at the large universe like ours.
How many cycles?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we could ever find out. Okay, so only a small fraction of our universe. We'll actually make it through. And the rest will crunch.
So instead of like the universe just cools down to be really, 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 really cold and dead, and this model says a small fraction. Is it like a small fraction is like connected or?
Yeah. No, no, it's connected.
It's a selected.
Exactly.
Selected.
Exactly. Yeah.
Universe.
It will be, you know, the region that has. I mean, you could have that in several different patches, of course. Uh-huh. You know, there could be several different seeds. Uh-huh. So you do. You can also get some sort of multiverse structure with this. Mm-hmm. so yeah, maybe I can, you know, just schematically, you can have like a habitable zone inside of your region. So this would be habitable. Like where we live. And then this rest would also be habitable. So all of this is basically our universe. Okay. So that's also habitable, but will crunch at the next cycle. Okay, so only this region will make it through. And then what you end up with and you could have another region like that. That will make it through. And then each of these would like spawn a new universe.
What are the type of conditions these batches like kind of like need?
Sorry?
What are these conditions, like habitable conditions?
Well, it's basically this condition that you need a successful ekpyrotic phase.
Okay.
Right, like we discussed yesterday. All of these regions where you don't actually end up with a good ekpyrotic phase that lasts long enough to suppress all the anisotropies will give you this BKL instability, which will give you a crunch. Right? Yeah, good point. Another remark would be that because we have this huge growth per cycle, we actually avoid the buildup of entropy. Because the entropy is diluted during each cycle. I mean, overall it increases, but then locally it can evolve cyclically. Right? So this is how we solve the entropy problem. Right, so it's diluted, and then because only a small region with the diluted entropy density basically makes it through to the next crunch, we start again with a low entropy. So, right, I should probably move on because, yeah, sorry, no, go ahead.
Entropy. So does the parts that crunch, the entropy that was there just disappears?
I guess. Good question. Well, it's definitely not part of our universe anymore. So I guess you could say that if you were to look at the whole system, right, containing all the different universes and parts of universes that have crunched, the entropy of all of that will always increase. So that's good, right? That's according to our laws of thermodynamics. But then locally, in just our universe, or the one that will spawn from it in the next cycle, you get this, you always get also a small entropy that then becomes bigger and then diluted and small becomes bigger. So, yeah.
So the idea of this crunch and go through is that that picture is like space dependent. That's the potential.
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this would be the region which goes through.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, you could imagine that not everywhere. Mm-hmm. Does your scalar field have a potential like that? And then those regions would crunch if it doesn't have a successful ekpyrotic phase. Okay. I just realized I'm taking way longer than I should. So let's quickly go through a few more models. One's called anti-gravity, developed by Itzhak Bass and others. And it basically minimally, conformally extends the standard model with scalar fields coupled to gravity, which are lifted by lifted to a violin invariant theory. And this leads to a brief anti-gravity phase around t equal to zero. And the claim is then that this allows for geodesically complete and unambiguous evolution through the singularity. Now, of course, not everyone agrees with that. Otherwise, we would know about the theory. Okay, if you want to know more, just ask me and I can point you towards the relevant papers. Okay, so I have the perfect bounds and the ghost condensate on my list, but I'm not going to mention them because we're going to go into some detail right about after this. It's also something called generalized Galileans, or Kondesky theory. It's the same thing. And they describe the most general single scalar field Lagrangian that contains higher order derivatives, but you still end up with only second order equations of motion. So we add scalar fields, so we're in the first category, exotic matter. And then these non-canonical scalar fields can induce a bounce, but you also preserve the smooth and flat conditions that you created beforehand, and you avoid instabilities during the bounce. And also they can be implemented in supergravity, so that's cool. And then we also have massive gravity. As the name suggests, you modify gravity in such a way that the graviton becomes massive. And with that, you can construct non-singular bounces as well. Okay, there are many others, like F of R theory, Gauss-Bonnet gravity. I mentioned yesterday, I think, that you can also use spinners and also torsion. And the list goes on, but of course we can't cover them all. So, there are no questions about any of these? Or maybe you can just ask afterwards. Let's move to the ghost condensate bonds. Okay, let us consider the following Lagrangian. We have gravity. We have some function k of phi and a function t of phi with x and x squared. I'll just give me a second. Where x is basically just your standard kinetic term. So it's minus a half g mu nu, d mu phi, d nu phi. Okay? So that's the ordinary kinetic term, but then in our Lagrangian, we have some phi-dependent function that multiplies it, and we also have the square of the kinetic term in addition to it. So just to see during the ekparotic phase, you would have just simply k equal to 1 and t equal to 0, and the potential would just be your negative exponential that way before, right? Okay. So basically what I'm trying to say is you could have in a bigger model, you could have first an ekparotic phase, and then you could have a ghost condensate bounds as your bounds. All described by, well, here you would need a second scalar, but you would need one scalar to drive the bounds. Okay, so for example, and this is just really a simple example, you can think of other potentials. Let's take k equal to 1 minus 2 over 1 plus phi squared, and t of phi, some value tb, which would be the value at the bounds, and then also over 1 plus phi squared. Okay, so if we just draw them so you can get an idea what they look like. K would be doing something like this, where this is minus 1. This over here is 1. Okay, and then, of course, dependent on the value of TB, that would be something like this, where up here is TB. Right. I think you've already learned that you can get the energy density and the pressure in a general setting from this equation. T mu nu is equal to minus 2 over minus square root of determinant of G. And then you have to vary the Lagrangian with respect to the metric, inverse metric. Okay, and then you get rho from the 0,0 component, and you get p from the ii component. Right, so as an exercise, you could do that if you wanted to, get the energy density by plugging in the Lagrangian in here and differentiating. I'll just do it for you. Rho is equal to a half k of phi dot squared, plus 3 over 4 t of phi dot to the 4, plus v. And the pressure is equal to something quite similar, a half k of phi dot squared, plus 1 quarter t of phi dot to the 4 minus v of phi. Okay, so now we can add the two together, right? remember, for violating the null energy condition, this combination has to become negative. So let's just add these up, and pretty easy, get k phi, k of phi, phi dot squared, plus t of phi, phi dot to the fourth. Okay, and actually, the critical point is at the bounds, so when phi goes to zero. So let's just look at what we get at phi equal to zero. We just look at our functions, plug it in. So k of phi becomes minus 1, because 1 minus 2. So that's just minus phi dot squared. And t of phi just becomes tb. OK, so basically, the condition for us to get a bounce is to violate the null energy condition. So that has to become negative. So that means that phi dot squared has to be less than 1 over tb. OK, and if we can manage a theory, well, if we put that into our theory, we will obtain a smooth bounce. OK, I mentioned yesterday that one of the problems is, though, if you want to violate the null energy condition, is that you often introduce ghosts. So the question is, how do we avoid these in this model? In order to see this, let's briefly look at the time-dependent perturbations only. So we write phi as a background value and a perturbation, delta phi. Okay. And then we can, if we plug that into our Lagrangian, we can look at the second order, so the quadratic part of the Lagrangian. And it will contain terms from the kinetic term right, so I'm only writing down the terms that will give me quadratic bits. So here it's easy, it's just the perturbation squared. Okay, and here you would still have to extract the quadratic contribution. And then when we look at that at phi equal to zero at the important moment, from this term, k is just minus 1 at the bounds. So this will give us minus 1/2. And then here you would have to look at the cross term between the background and the perturbation with two perturbation components, which gives you just 6 phi bar dot squared, delta phi squared. The delta phi squared is here, delta phi dot, sorry. And then 6 times a quarter, it's just 3 over 2. You can get the value tb from here, and then phi bar dot squared. OK. Right. So in order to avoid ghosts, we need the kinetic term to have the right sign. It must be positive. So that means we need phi dot squared to be larger than 1 over 3 tb to avoid ghosts. OK. So combined with this constraint, what we need for our theory to work is we need 1 over 3TB to be less than pi dot squared at the bounds to be less than 1 over TB. Okay. And that's, of course, possible. So we can have our smooth Antikos 3 bounds. Okay. So as has should have become obvious, we need the higher derivative terms. So we need that x squared bit in order to, you know, obtain this contribution, which can cancel or turn this minus sign into a plus sign. So these are crucial to ensure stability. We've also only looked at temporal perturbations, and in this have neglected the spatial perturbations. But of course, they are very important because they can lead to gradient instabilities as well. So we need to make sure that we don't have those either. And what you often do is you add these Galileans also. they basically work in a very similar way. And they also make sure that you don't run into any gradient instabilities. Okay, and then one last remark is that it has been shown numerically that long wavelength fluctuations can propagate unharmed through such a bounce. So what that means is that you can actually trace the perturbations from their generation, say during an apoptotic phase, all the way through the bounds, and they emerge like you put them in on the other side. Are there any questions about this model?
What's the significance of this last comment? Like, could that be used to determine if we're in a bouncing cosmology?
The significance is that it's not, you know, from a theoretical point of view, people. Even though this analysis would show that nothing dramatic happens at the bounds, it's not 100% clear whether that means that the perturbations actually just go through, right? Something could happen to them. We could change their spectrum by them going through the bounds. And so what they've done in this paper is to just, you know, implement such a bounce numerically, send the fluctuations in, and actually see, you know, what happens to them during the bounce. And they found that, you know, all is good. They're not, you know, catastrophically altered, or they don't behave in a bad way. Actually, there's one caveat which I should add is they don't behave bad as long as you're within the regime of validity of your model, right? So what that means is that this is, again, it's an effective model, right? So there is a cutoff to the theory beyond which it's not valid anymore. It's like a low energy description, low, right? So all the wavelengths that are within this cutoff are unaffected by the bounds. What they found is that weird things happen to, you know, the wavelengths that are beyond the cutoff, but then you can't trust your theory anyway. I mean, that's what the cutoff means, right? So, yeah. Does that answer your question?
Why do you call this model gauss condensate?
If you want to violate the null energy condition, it usually introduces ghosts if you just do it naively. And then I guess the people who first found that you get ghosts thought, okay, how do we avoid this? and then they called it gauss condensate. I don't know, there might be a deeper meaning to the word condensate, but I'm not If so, I'm not familiar with it. Does anyone else know? No? Okay. I think it's just that. Okay, so quickly, let's talk about the perfect bounds. It's a model just from a couple of years ago by Stefan Gielen and Neil Turk. And it's a model for bounds in quantum cosmology, you could say. And in their papers, they use the Feynman path integral to compute probability amplitudes for the whole universe to evolve through the singularity. Now, it's very technical, so I'm not going to go through that here. No time also. But the way this Feynman path integral mechanism works is that it's very analogous to what we see in quantum tunneling. Right, and I might expand on that a bit. Okay, so the main idea is to extend quantum cosmology in a minimal way. So that means to put in as few assumptions as possible. I have a list of principles that they use. I think the most important one might be that they extend your scale factor A to negative values, right? Which would basically still describe a classical universe. There's, in theory, nothing wrong with that. In the metric, in physical equations, A usually appears as A squared. But then they also go to complex values. Because we can. Okay. And that doesn't mean that our universe is complex, right? What it means is that you want to describe quantum bits with it. Right, so you can use, this is basically a mathematical construction that will allow you to describe the quantum regime. And I don't know how far you've come in any of your quantum courses. If you've ever seen complex values being used for quantum processes. I've personally been working on quantum tunneling, and we also make use of that a lot. Okay. Right. The next principle would be that they don't actually impose any boundary conditions at A equals to zero. A equals to zero is problematic, right? It's the singularity. We don't know what happens there. So instead, let's impose boundary conditions at A goes to plus minus infinity, right? So into the far future and far past. And we have kind of an idea what happens there. We just extrapolate in our universe, it's dark energy dominated. Okay, right. And then from this, what they show is that you can actually avoid the singularity in the complex plane. And then the question they ask is, can we send something, like a wave, can we send something in the far past and calculate what comes out in the far future in an unambiguous and well-defined way, even though there's a singularity in the middle? And the answer they find is yes. Because they're not actually going through to A equal to zero, but what we're doing is if you look at A in the complex plane, you send something in with negative A. That is like a contracting universe, basically. and you want something out in our expanding universe. Right. And then what they do is they basically go around the only critical point, which is a equal to zero, in the complex plane, and find that you can do that. Okay, so this would describe a collapsing universe. Here. And you would just end in a crunch if you wouldn't be able to go around. This is an expanding universe. And then if you do allow A to become complex, you can connect these, as I've just drawn, in the complex plane. Right, so pictorially, if you wanted to like draw the light cone of our universe, there would be something weird quantum happening in the middle. And then there would be another kind of contracting universe on the other side. And this thing that happens in the middle, that's what I mentioned in the beginning, is kind of analogous to tunneling. It's just that here, we're basically working with space-time. So space-time itself is tunneling, in a way. It's not like just, you know, an electron can tunnel through a barrier. It's space-time itself. All right, I should say this simplest example works in a radiation-dominated universe, so you need the radiation. Oh yeah, also flat, flat FRW filled with radiation. Okay, I have more things to say, but we've run out of time. What do we do? what I wanted to talk about or show you quickly is what the A less than zero means. And then I wanted to have a look at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which describes the universe as a whole, and show you how we get basically solutions that as they come in, they go out. So they're not affected by the singularity. I could also type this up and send it to you. I don't know how long it will take.
Depends how long you, because there's a next class.
Right, when does it start?
15 past? 15 past, and normally they want a break.
All right, okay. Okay, so I'll try and be quick. If I take too long, tell me, make me stop. Sorry. Okay, so very quickly. you can write down gravity in the Einstein-Hilbert action, like you've all seen before. Let me just denote these coordinates by a tilde. Okay, so that's the standard way. However, it contains this dimensionful parameter g Newton. And what we can do now is to use the so-called Stückelberg trick to remove this this dimensionful parameter by making g dynamical. So what that means is we will introduce an extra field. Which, as always, we call phi. but then also, we introduce an additional symmetry, right? So what that means is that we can use this additional symmetry to go back to this original action by gauge fixing. And that means the action that I'm about to write down has the same number of degrees of freedom. So even though it looks like we've introduced a degree of freedom by introducing an additional scalar field, it's not actually a physical scalar field because we also introduced the additional symmetry. Right, okay. Okay. We introduce scalar field, but also an additional symmetry. So no extra degrees of freedom. Okay, and then if you choose a new method, choose a new. With a bunch of other things like this phi, and then constants and d Newton, we can get to a new form of the action. Now in terms of g, and it looks like this. Okay, notice we have a scalar field, kinetic term, but then also we have a coupling between this scalar field and the Ricci scalar. Okay, so this is not the Einstein frame anymore. The Einstein frame always has R without any couplings. Right, and the cool thing about this action now is that it allows for a wild transformation, so a conformal transformation, where G goes to some omega squared g. And if you also send phi to phi over omega, this leaves the action invariant. Okay, so we say that this action is Weyl invariant, or conformally invariant. Okay, you could say we've basically introduced a fake Weyl invariance into our action by using the Stickelberg trick. But as I said, at the classical level at least, these two are completely equivalent. Okay, then they go on to show that you can write your scale factor, A, in terms of the energy density in the radiation field that we've added. In terms of the metric, and in terms of the scalar field phi. And they basically show that this is the unique combination that is Weyl invariant, has the correct physical dimensions, and that reduces to the scale factor that we know from, well, just the radiation-dominated scale factor that we would get in the if we were to transform back into the Einstein frame. And you can see that these two are positive, so to answer the question, what does it mean for A to become negative? It basically just means whenever phi, this extra field that we've introduced, becomes negative, that also means that A would become negative. So it, you know, it's a bit like a, I don't know, I don't want to say it's a trick, but yeah, well. Okay, so then, quickly, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is usually just written down like this. It's basically the It's basically just the Hamiltonian constraint on the wave function of the universe, whatever that means. this should be an equal sign, of course, is equal to zero. Okay, so the wave function of the universe. Well, now I know what I did. The wave function of the universe is a wave function that's defined on superspace. Not space-time. So what that means is that it contains all information about the geometry and the matter content of the universe. And then, so this comes basically from the canonical quantization that I mentioned in the beginning. And if you want to know more about it, ask afterwards. Because very quickly, what they get in their model is just an equation, second order differential equation for the scale factor, which looks like the Schrödinger equation with a 1 over a squared potential and an energy m squared. And this c is just a constant that can have contributions from whatever else you put into your model. So we need the radiation, but we could also add minimally coupled scalars, like actual scalars, not the kind of trick scalar here. Conformally coupled scalars you could add, and you could also add anisotropies, and they would all end up in this constant here. So they would all end up with a 1 over a squared in the equation. Right. And the mass here is essentially just the total energy in the radiation fluid. So the radiation density times 3 volume. Okay. It's very easily solved, at least asymptotically. There are two possible solutions. And they go like either e to the minus or plus IMA. And this is true both at a goes to plus infinity or minus infinity. Okay, so that's basically showing you that if you send in a positive frequency wave at minus infinity, so you pick out the minus sign, positive frequency is just by convention with the minus sign, you send that in, you also get the same thing out. And if you were to send in a negative frequency solution at minus infinity, you would also get out a negative frequency solution at plus infinity. Okay, so that basically means that our potential here is kind of invisible. And you know, there are systems in quantum mechanics where you just have a 1 over x squared potential, for example, where the same thing happens. So this is not something new, the fact that you can't see the potential. But of course, in this context, what it means is you can't see the singularity, right? It's like it wasn't really there. Right. That's basically all I wanted to say. Any questions?
Yes, I have a question. What does it mean to, like you said you applied the Hamiltonian constraint to the wave function of universe?
Yeah.
Well, how do you make the Hamiltonian constraint an operator, and what does it mean to apply to the wave function?
Yeah, it's very complicated. It's basically this canonical quantum gravity quantization procedure developed by Dirac and David and Bergman that you would need to use.
In that context, that but I wanted to know if it was the same thing.
Okay. Yeah, no, this is all, you know, very heuristic.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in this equation if you actually wanted to know what it means and what it does.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Maybe you have a quantum gravity course at some point.
Yeah.
Quantum
gravity is
next.
Well, go to that. Okay. More questions? Oh, you can just also come find me afterwards.
Thank you.